This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was Alan Alberding, who's the president of the Joyce Foundation, a 70-year-old foundation that has been making grants for seven decades to improve the quality of life in the Midwest. The Joyce Foundation has $1 billion in assets and every year doles out $50 million in grants. Their focus is on children, the workforce, violence, and the environment. These are policy issues. So they're very interested in government and those who put officials there, e.g. the voters. Alberding pointed out that in 2014's midterm elections, only 37% of the eligible voters bothered to go to the polls. She says we must improve on this. She talked about education, with more kids going to college, more kids graduating college from the city of Chicago, but at the same time, she talked about the high dropout rate among African-American males and Latino males. She talked about a subject called patient capital, a new idea, long-term investment that will take a while before any of us see dividends. The foundation this year will focus on the environment, particularly with more concern with low-income communities, also the issue of guns. She said it's insanity not to regulate guns and their use. She urged people who have guns to join a gun safety organization. Educate yourself on where your public officials are on guns and take steps to keep guns out of the wrong hands. She also said she is a strong supporter of a sane Second Amendment. The key to making these changes, she feels, is voting. Alberding said elections matter and elections have consequences. We must fight against those who wish to suppress voters. And she finished up by talking about the need for a strong, independent media, particularly currently with all of the attacks on the media. She said, if we don't have a strong, independent media, who will monitor public officials and look into their acts and lack of acts? It'll be very interesting because, she said, the Joyce Foundation will double down on their grants to those who are involved in strengthening our media.
I wanted to just open today by thanking the fantastic team from the Joyce Foundation that are here at a couple of tables. And in particular, I wanted to introduce you to three new people who've joined the team recently, and I hope you'll all have an opportunity to work with them. First is Carrie Davis, who's now the program director of our democracy program. We persuaded Carrie to move here from Ohio, where she was the executive director of the League of Women Voters. Second is Casey Adeiro, who has had a fantastic career as a journalist, working on the Hill with Robin Kelly, which has been so helpful for us as we shape our messaging on guns. It was just lovely to have you on our team, Casey. And finally, we stole someone from the MacArthur Foundation. I'm so glad Julie's not here today. Soledad McGrath, who is working in our criminal justice reform arena. I also want to thank my husband and my entire family for being here, which is why it's a sellout. You know, I just figured I didn't want to take any chances. Let me start by telling you a quick story that came to mind as I began thinking about the state of our democracy. On a snowy night about 10 years ago, I was a volunteer poll watcher in a low-income African-American community in Cleveland, Ohio. I was watching a stream of voters come through, go down the long, you know, aisle of the school gymnasium, and one guy caught my eye. He was a quite an older fellow, and he was an African-American man using a walker. And he had trudged through one of the worst icy snowstorms I've ever seen and really wanted to be able to vote in this election that eventually was going to elect the first African-American president. He didn't have the proper papers. He got all the way up to the table to vote, and he did not have the proper papers because Ohio had made rules making it harder to vote and requiring a particular kind of ID that that gentleman did not have. So they gave him what's called a provisional ballot. He was not sure that his vote would ever be counted, and frankly, I was quite skeptical that it would be counted either. In fact, as I left that evening after the polls were closed, I was out in the parking lot getting into my rental car, and I saw a box of ballots sitting on the ground in the parking lot in the snow. And that box of ballots, as far as I know, was never picked up. That moment has struck with me for 10 years as a symbol of how delicate and fragile our democracy really is. Our precious right to vote and to be heard, to have a stake in the outcome, can be so easily thwarted, and it's under constant assault, more so now than at any time in recent memory. Communities are being systematically disenfranchised, be it through restrictive voter ID laws, gerrymandering, primitive paper balloting systems, or even sophisticated electronic systems that are easily hacked. What happens is that citizens start questioning the integrity of the vote, and by extension, whether they should vote at all. Some feel that voting is an exercise in futility. Others, that their vote won't change anything, or that they'll face obstacles at the polling place. So voter turnout, which is really the engine of change, is falling. And as an example, you may have heard this before, but it's really a shocking number. In the 2014 midterm elections, only 37% of people who are eligible to vote actually voted. In fact, voting and other forms of civic participation are among the most important things we can do to make sure our country and our democracy stay strong. As you may know, the Joyce Foundation focuses almost entirely on policy. Policy is made by elected officials and those in government who are placed there, ultimately, by us as citizens. Why do we think public policy matters so much that we spend all of our time, all of our energy, and all of our money? Because it matters. It matters for the people that we hope to serve and that you all care for. That older gentleman who was determined to vote, it matters for him. The families in Flint, Michigan, who were paying the highest water rates in the United States, even as their drinking water was tainted with lead. The millions of workers in the Midwest trying to find their place in a changing economy. The children in Chicago living with the daily threat of gun violence. Or those high school students in Parkland, Florida, demanding to know why the adults in Washington put the interests of a powerful gun lobby above the lives of their classmates. The Joyce Foundation has focused on these issues for many years, but last year we took a sharper look at the needs of the people in our region, and we learned in a few things. So in 2018, which is actually our 70th year of making grants, we're making some changes. The research that we did showed us some important trends in the six Great Lakes where we work, which, to remind you, are Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio. One thing we learned is that the population projections in the next 20 years shows that our population as a whole is going to grow more slowly than that of the rest of the United States. It also shows us that now we are whiter and older than the rest of the United States. But we will be growing, and that growth is almost entirely going to come from young people of color who are born in the region. It's obvious to people who live in Chicago that we are a more diverse community because Chicago is already a majority-minority community. But it's true in other parts of the region as well. Wisconsin, for example, the population of Latinos doubled between 2000 and 2015, which makes it the fastest-growing ethnic and racial group in the state of Wisconsin. Looking at the economy, we see a region that has struggled more than most regions of the country, primarily from the loss of good-paying jobs due to automation and globalization. Some Midwestern cities, and I'm happy to say Chicago is one of them, but also Minneapolis and Columbus, are doing really well. But many smaller cities and rural areas are suffering, which leaves people feeling alienated and without hope. In many cases, jobs are there, but they're not available to folks who lack training in the skills that employers need, or for those folks who did not continue their education beyond high school. The Great Lakes region also suffers from huge disparities in opportunity because of economic and racial segregation. This is something that I didn't really understand before we did this research, but of the five most segregated cities in America, four of them are in our region, and they are Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, and Cleveland. That's sort of a shocking fact. With young people of color driving population growth and, we hope, economic growth in the region over the next 20 years, we want to support their success in education, careers, and community, their health, and their safety. Our future really depends on it. So Joyce is not going to make radical changes in the subjects that we're focusing on. We will continue to work on gun violence, on education, on environment. We'll continue to have a vital culture program and work on democracy. But we will now have a laser focus on how we can advance racial and economic mobility in the next generation. For the young people of color who will be defining our future, that starts with education, and I'm so happy to report some really good news on that topic. Some of you may already know that Chicago's public schools have evolved from what one former U.S. Secretary of Education described as the worst in the nation. It is now considered a national model for improving student achievement in large urban school systems. Not too long ago, few would have imagined a headline like this one, which appeared recently in the Washington Post. Which is somewhere. That's a pretty amazing thing. That story was just published, but obviously the trends that led to that story have been developing for over 30 years, and it may have been unnoticed by many of us, including those working in the area. The changes have their roots in governance changes, the hard work of educators, political courage, the kind of nuts and bolts reforms that don't always make headlines, and, Diana, investments in early childhood education. The data tells the story. There's a Stanford researcher, highly respected, Sean Reardon, who issued a report recently showing that Chicago is the fastest improving big city school district in the country. Reardon's research found that CPS students are gaining 6 years of learning in 5 years of school. Okay, the only thing you need to know about this chart is that that reddish-orange dot is Chicago. That's Chicago way above everyone else, including New York, L.A., Winnetka. So for a district the size of ours and with the so many setbacks that we've had, it's really an astounding achievement. The good news is not limited to test scores. Another independent study from the University of Chicago's Consortium on School Research shows that our schools have gotten more academically rigorous, graduation rates are up, more kids are going to college, and more kids are completing college. Now, this success did not happen on its own. A lot of dedicated people in and around CPS and the city have been working for years on this. And here's what we've done. We've increased choice, we have more high-quality schools, we've supported principals as leaders of their schools and improved teacher quality. We've empowered parents, improved curriculum, increased access to the arts, and of course the students themselves are motivated and working hard. But it's taken a really, really long time. And funders like Joyce and others in this room have been willing to invest during long periods when we did not see much, if any, progress. I like to borrow a term from the financial industry to call it patient capital, a long-term investment that takes time to mature. It's not all good news, of course, when it comes to schools. There's still so much work to be done. One of the big concerns that we have is that too many CPS kids who go on to community college still need remediation. They take remedial classes when they get into city colleges. And, of course, once you're in a remediation program, it's really, really difficult to complete your program and to graduate. Graduating is key. Study after study shows that the economic value of a two-year or four-year college degree is critical. So if students from low-income families are going to move up the economic ladder, they have to get through college. And as Sherry knows, and I think has talked about really eloquently, the college gaps between rich and poor students, between black and white students, are enormous. And in many cases, these gaps have grown over the last few years. This is a challenge that we will take on. We hope to work with Sherry and many other folks in this room to figure out solutions to that and to do something about it. Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you.
I'm going to switch a little bit just to talk about our environment program, which also will be focusing much more specifically on the concerns of low-income communities. Our environment program, for example, has added a new priority to make safe and affordable drinking water available for everyone. The Great Lakes hold 90% of the country's fresh water, surface water, and they supply drinking water to nearly 50 million people in the United States and Canada. Yet amazingly, some people living just a few miles from this rich supply of fresh water can't afford to pay their water bills. The Chicago Tribune did a great job documenting this in a series last fall on water rates in some low-income suburbs. The series also showed that we're losing billions of gallons of water each year because water systems all over the region are falling apart and leaking, so that precious resource is going through the pipes and leaking right into the ground. Of course, everyone here knows what happened in Flint, but many communities, not only lower-income ones, are dealing with the challenge of providing safe and affordable drinking water. And Mike Kelly, apologies, but you may remember that the high lead counts found in the Chicago Park District's drinking fountains last year is a particular issue that sort of got everybody's attention. To one degree or another, these problems are all related to our failure to modernize and maintain our infrastructure. Everybody suffers, but the burden is greatest on the poor. Now I'm going to turn to guns. It won't surprise you to know in this environment that the Joyce Foundation is doubling down on its emphasis on gun violence. Thank you. For many years, the foundation has been pushing for common sense gun laws to get guns off the street, and for almost all of those years, my wonderful colleague Nina Vinnig has been leading the charge. So thank you, Nina, for the great work that you do. A few days ago, I was stopped on the street by a friend and colleague who said something along the lines of, "Oh, Ellen, you were so right that if we didn't do something about guns, this country was just going to have more and more violence." I appreciated her comment, but who wants to be right about something like that? Certainly not me. Every year, 7,000 children and teens are injured or killed by guns. There's no other country in the world that experiences anything close to this. No other country accepts the slaughter of children in classrooms as an acceptable price to pay for an unfettered right to own guns. The tragic shooting in Florida. Picture the parents panicked, the children terrified, the police, the ambulances, the injury and death. It all highlights the insanity of our failure to reasonably regulate guns and their use, the way we regulate any number of other products that cause a lot less harm. We can only hope and help that the outrage of these high school students from Parkland and around the country will be sustained because they are driving the debate on guns right now. Their power as future voters, as consumers, and as leaders cannot be overestimated, and it must be supported. Their voices are strong, but they cannot do this alone. Even if you are a gun owner, you can be part of the solution. One simple step is to store your guns safely at home. Research tells us that only about one-third of parents store their firearms unloaded and locked, even when they had children with depression or other risk factors. Yet guns in the home are a known risk factor for suicide and domestic violence. And whether or not you are a gun owner, if you want to see change, find out where your elected officials stand on these issues and let them know your views. There is overwhelming public support around so many gun safety laws. There is overwhelming consensus among the experts that gun safety laws can work. And by the way, the idea of arming teachers is not one of those ideas. It is merely It is merely a tactic designed to distract us from the real problem, which is easy access to guns. If our lawmakers keep failing to act, the only lasting solution is to make this a voting issue. Now let me switch to Chicago. As we know, the gun violence problem here in Chicago is unique and it's acute. With 650 homicides last year, 760 homicides the year before, we have lost more lives to guns in the last 2 years than the cities of New York and LA combined, and they have four times the population. The Joyce Foundation is working in partnership with other funders to tackle this problem, and I want to give a shout out to my friend Julie Stash of the MacArthur Foundation, who's been a wonderful partner to me and a great leader on this issue locally in a very quiet way, and it's been really a good partnership. The partnership as a whole has about 35 members and participants, and it's taking a holistic approach to Chicago's gun violence. We're supporting many community-based efforts that are already underway. We're funding street-level interventions, counseling, and jobs for high-risk young men, efforts to rebuild relationships between police and community, and to further professionalize the police department. And of course, we'll be evaluating the impact of this work over time. But let me go back to voting. The most profound act of personal responsibility in the United States today is to vote. If you care about gun violence or climate change or economic inequality or institutional racism, or a government that represents any one of your concerns, you need to vote and get others who share your views out to vote as well. Elections matter, and as we have found out, elections have consequences. We know this all too well. We have learned that our democracy does not run on autopilot. We cannot take it for granted. There are forces out there in our politics, and I would call them anti-democratic forces, that are working to suppress voter turnout among the poor and people of color. They want to limit census participation among certain groups by requiring a question asking if you are a U.S. citizen. They want to maintain gerrymandered districts where politicians choose their voters instead of the other way around. Just since 2010, 23 states have passed voter ID laws, making it harder for low-income people and people of color to vote. Folks, this is a democracy. Shouldn't we be making it easier for people to vote? Isn't that the point? We've all seen a new wave of political activism in this country. Women, young people, people of color, particularly Black Lives Matter, are more energized than they've ever been before. Artists like these 2018 Joyce Award winners are making their experience part of the conversation as well. We can take advantage of this energy to advance racial, economic, and social equity by increasing participation in the electoral process. And there has been progress on that front. For example, Illinois passed and the governor signed an automatic voter registration bill. Nine other states have done it the same, which is designed to increase ballot access. Redistricting reform is moving forward in some Midwestern states, and the U.S. Supreme Court is poised to make a really important ruling on the constitutional limits of the extreme partisan gerrymandering on a case from Wisconsin. So there's reason to be hopeful, but we also must be vigilant. Supporting a strong democracy means also supporting a strong independent media to hold our elected officials accountable to the people they serve. As we've seen in environmental debates where science is ignored or discredited, or on guns where we hear that the answer is more guns, or on voting rights where false propaganda about non-existent voting fraud drives one side of the debate, the assault on the media and the intentional blurring of the truth has blurred the debate in ways that makes it harder and harder to find common ground and solve problems. So we need strong independent journalism, and the Joyce Foundation and others will be investing in those opportunities. I'd like to close with a final observation. Anybody who works on long, tough, long-term policy challenges needs to be patient. And there's a natural tension between the urgency of now and patient capital. I was born in 1958, and you don't need to do the math. I have a big birthday coming up. This was 1 year after the public schools in Little Rock, Arkansas, were forcibly integrated by the federal government. I recently visited that high school in Little Rock, where nine brave young people endured abuse, hate, and the threat of violence simply to acquire something that we should all take for granted, which is a decent education. I grew up watching these issues play out in the 1960s and 1970s, expecting that someday soon we would reach a state of genuine equity and tolerance, and that these fights would be in the past. Sadly, they're still with us. Segregation, quality education, voting rights, and a fair shot at the American dream are not guaranteed, even when you have the law on your side. At the same time, we can't act as if time is on our side. Every year that a child suffers a second-rate education is a lost opportunity. Every life lost to senseless gun violence is irreplaceable. I was so moved by that elderly gentleman making his way to the polling place in Cleveland 10 years ago. He summoned the strength to make that long walk through the storm. He had the dignity to persist in the face of resistance. And what I saw that night really still inspires me. It inspires me to work to ensure that the votes and voices of people like him and everyone in this room count. Every one of us can play a role. Participate. Participate in issues that you care about, no matter what they are. Vote. Help our democracy stay strong. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ellen. Thank you. Don't leave the dais, please. We have some questions in that. And thank you for throwing out those challenges to us. If anyone has any questions that you would like to bring up to the podium, if you just hold up your blue forms, we have Alex. I see one in the back of the room, Alex, from our staff. Or Sam, you're probably closer. Sam, straight back and across. You know, we have so many people here for Ellen Alberding that we don't have room between the tables to walk. We're going to have to build a second tier. That's what Governor Jackie Robinson-Ivey is investigating.
You can't give me my mug either, because I'm using it.
And we now have a used City Club mug. Usually we give our speakers a brand new one. Jay, I don't know what's happening with our budget that we're using used mugs. Okay. Thanks, Sam. Okay. Well, we have to ask this one first because it's from a pastor. Pastor Chris Harris in the back. As founder and CEO of Bright Star Community Outreach's Turn Center, the pastor's amazed how little focus is placed on trauma and mental health. How important do you think this focus is to decrease violence in Chicago?
Well, I'm not a medical professional, but it's clearly a huge issue both for educational outcomes as well as proclivity to have lots of negative life outcomes. So it's something that we're very, very aware of, and I think educators in general and people in the mental health community are very aware of it. The trauma that's experienced by young people who are trying to get to school safely, it's hard to imagine how you can then focus on your Algebra 1 or, you know, what you're facing in your 8:30 a.m. class. So it's a giant issue, and we acknowledge it. Thank you for bringing it up. It's one to keep bringing up.
Okay, thank you. This is from City Club speaker and longtime member Dave Hiller. What are the prospects of gun reform in Illinois? And just yesterday we saw in the news that Superintendent Johnson and members of the Chicago Police Department and else. Other departments went down to testify on what we hope will become the Bowler bill.
There was, when it came to voting on it in committee, there was it broke along partisan lines, 8-5 in favor of the bill. So what do you feel are the prospects of gun reform in Illinois?
Well, as David knows, I can't really comment on specific legislation because we're a 501c3 private foundation. But, you know, is there a sea change? Has something happened that's different from the past crises? I'm somewhat optimistic that yes. And I think the corporate actions that have been taken recently are a really interesting indicator of change because, boy, we had to fight long and hard to get a couple of changes in the past few years, and these things are happening almost spontaneously. I was particularly thrilled to see Gucci give $500,000 to the march. It now makes me feel like I need to go straight to Gucci and support them myself. But all kidding aside, I mean, there's two things that I think are interesting to think about. One is these big corporations, Delta, United Airlines, Dick's, they're not making these changes without some understanding of their client base. They're not motivated purely by being good guys, but they're also very aware of the purchasing habits and the interests of their clients. Now, we're not privy to that information, but it's interesting for me to think about and interesting for, you know, we'll see if more things like that happen. The other thing I'm intrigued by, but we don't really have any evidence about yet, is, you know, think about, like, many people in this room grew up in that era that I described of watching civil rights battles, and that sort of forms your mindset. Well, young people now, 15 to 27, 28-year-olds, grew up in an era of Columbine and school shootings, and, you know, is this forming a different kind of thinking about what should and could be done on this, you know, very, very difficult issue? So, predicting things in Springfield is not my specialty, but I'm certainly hopeful that there will be something that comes through that's that will make a difference that isn't, sort of fatally softened.
Thank you. Two people submitted a similar question. Mary Sue Barrett of the Metropolitan Planning Council and Angelique Power with the Field Foundation of Illinois. And basically, both thank you for your intensified focus on racial equity and economic mobility. How can the Joyce Foundation support other organizations, local, state, government, I think this is banks, and take a similar step?
So if I understand the question, it's can we be influential with other organizations? Is that what you're asking, Mary Sue? Or do you want to reframe it? I'm not totally.
I think the statement on racial equity and economic mobility is a very strong one. So, yes, inspiring others.
Well, I think sharing the data is persuasive. Because if you look at where the growth is, if you understand that the growth in our region is going to come from young people of color, they're going to be born here and they are going to populate our states and they are going to drive change in our states. So focusing on having excellent educational outcomes, safety, and excellent work opportunities is critical to maintaining the health of our region and spreading the benefits more widely. Now, you did some great work with the Urban Institute that really documented the impact of segregation on the prospects for young people. And I think that's something, like working on segregation, you know, housing, and there are a whole bunch of issues tangled up in that we don't work on, but joining hands with others that do, like you and many others in this room, is really a critical part of addressing those issues. So in that way, and Angelique, where's Angelique? Thank you for calling that out. I mean, I think in that way we can all work together with our own pieces to really make change on these issues. So,
okay, thank you. To shift the focus just a little bit, Helen, this is from Charlie Gardner, City Club member, Roosevelt University trustee. What did you do with that box of ballots?
Yeah, that's a good question, Charlie. So, you know, I wasn't allowed to touch the box of ballots. And actually, it was several boxes of ballots. And I called the Board of Elections and I reported it to the poll-watching legal organization. There were a bunch of injunctions stopping the counting that in that particular election. It was a mess. So I made a bunch of phone calls and reported it and did everything I could. But I was not allowed to physically pick up that box of ballots. I don't know what happened. I'm guessing that box of ballots is still sitting there 10 years later, but, you know, I don't know. So,
okay. This is from Linda Peters with the Northwest Housing Center. Would the Joyce Foundation be willing to consider a two-tier granting system whereby collaborations are eligible for a higher dollar amount of funding than single grantee applicants? We have some interesting questions.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, excellent. Because we have a lot of questions. So the answer to that, Linda, is sure. This is from Lydia, excuse me if I butcher your last name, Yankovskaya, who's the music director of the Chicago Opera Theater. In an increasingly more polarized political climate, the arts, which are inherently defined by a collaborative spirit, are essential. What is your stance on the importance of supporting the arts as agents of change?
Well, thank you for that softball question. So, Tracy Hall, if you would just stand and be acknowledged. Yay, Tracy. Angelique Power and Michelle Boone are also here, and they have jointly, two former folks working at the Joyce Foundation, have gradually moved the foundation to really, really focus on the issue of equity as it relates to the whole organization, but specifically to arts and culture. And I'm really thrilled at the work that Tracy is doing to link our interest in employment and great jobs with diversity and building pipelines for folks of color to get into the arts. And guess what? A lot of the high-paid jobs are behind the scenes. The electricians and the lighting folks, you know, those union jobs are really important. But also supporting community-based arts artists and smaller organizations that are reflecting the interests of and deeply embedded in their communities. So those are the two priorities that I can articulate for our program right now. So I think that addresses the question, but it also gives me a moment to really say how proud we are of where we've been and where we're going with Tracy's leadership. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Lydia, for that good question. And Lydia, you said you're not a City Club member, so we took in your question anyhow. Consider joint. No mug for you is right. Great. Question from Jill Reed from High Jump. Jill, where are you at? Right down there. Okay. She wonders if seeing the kids from Parkland advocating for themselves around gun control, has this spurred ideas for you and your colleagues at the Joyce Foundation?
Many, many ideas. So we're excited about the very significant contributions that are going to the students' organizations that are organizing the walkouts and organizing the march on March 24th. Those contributions are mostly going to a C4 organization, which can be more active politically than a C3 organization can. But what we're really thinking about diving deeply into understanding the mindset of youth in the country and figuring out, you know, whether we can spread this and make it last for a longer period of time. So those are the kinds of things that we can and will invest in. And, of course, if there are, you know, organizations in our region that need bus money to get kids out to the march and so on, we'll be doing some of that as well. But we're really interested in both understanding this movement and spreading the movement in ways that a C3 organization like ours is able to.
Thank you, Alan. We have time for two last questions. This one is from Yesenia Maldonado. She's with Between Friends. What do you see as the intersection between guns and domestic violence?
Well, there's a significant intersection between guns and domestic violence. Particularly, I mentioned in my talk that having unsecured guns in a home where there's domestic violence is a high risk factor for homicide. That is a well understood, well researched, well documented link. So that's unfortunately the short answer. I just wanted to go back to the high jump question, though. I wanted to give a shout out to Darlene Glanton in the Tribune. Yeah, Tribune. Mm-hmm. She wrote a really great piece a day or so ago where she said, what about, okay, this is great. It's great that these kids are getting all this attention. What about the brave Black Lives Matter kids? They're the same age. They were out there risking their lives. They were doing something really, really tough, and they deserve attention and support as well. So I wanted to just thank her for making that point and repeat it.
And Darlene is always welcome here at the City Club. She's been one of our speakers and has served on one of our panels. Thank you.